It's Wednesday, June 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, more tough talk between the United States and Iran.
When they're ready, they'll let us know. Very simple. Doesn't make any difference. Whatever they want to do, I'm ready.
Also ahead, a Mideast peace conference opens in Bahrain, but Israel and the Palestinians aren't there. The head of Customs and Border Protection says he's leaving. The first of two Democratic debates is later tonight, and some endangered black rhinos have a new home in Rwanda. That's all on today's International Edition. Top American and Iranian officials are continuing to fire verbal warning shots at each other while insisting they want to avoid war. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump told reporters in the Oval Office that whenever Iran is ready to talk, he is available. Earlier in the day, the president warned on social media that an attack by Tehran on anything American would be met with great and overwhelming force, adding that in some instances, overwhelming would mean obliteration. Trump pulled the United States out of a deal negotiated under the Obama administration that aimed to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Tuesday afternoon, the president repeated his assertion that the deal was a bad one for all involved.
As far as Iran is concerned, the deal was a horrible deal. It was no good. It was no good. It ended in a very short period of time. We're dealing about countries. It ended in a very short period of time. They would have had a clear path to a nuclear weapon. We're not going to allow that to happen. Can't do it.
Last week, Trump decided against a retaliatory strike against Iran just minutes before launch after Tehran shot down an unmanned drone. The United States has also blamed Iran for recent attacks on oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz. On Monday, Trump stiffened economic sanctions against the Islamic Republic, specifically targeting the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. An Iranian government official is quoted as saying that sanctions on Khamenei equal an attack on the nation, while Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, said in a televised address that the White House's actions were mentally retarded and that the sanctions would not harm the top cleric because he has no assets abroad. Jay Solomon is an adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and he's also the author of The Iran Wars. He spoke to International Edition's Laurie London about where all this could be headed.
I think at the heart of it is the fact that these economic sanctions are really hurting Iran. Their currency was down about two-thirds year on year before President Trump, about a month ago, said he was going to go for zero oil exports. And I think for Iran, that's an existential threat to that country because, you know, around 60% of the state's revenue comes from oil exports. So I think that's what's really the underlying threat. And I think the Trump administration doesn't really want to get sucked into a military conflict because they see the oil warfare, the financial warfare, having so much impact. So the Iranians can't sit back, really, and just let this type of financial pressure continue because of what it's doing to its finances. And it's kind of lashing out to try to bring the international community, to bring them into the fray so they'll force the U.S. to back off. And I guess we're sort of now in a game of chicken where the U.S. is actually escalating the sanctions. Iranians are saying they won't go back to the negotiating table. And if the last 2 weeks are any indication, there are likely to be more provocations in the Straits of Hormuz or other areas where Iranian proxies are active.
Ultimately, though, do you think that the sanctions will work if both sides are digging in their heels and just, you know, not willing to budge? Plus, of course, Iran saying this is the permanent closure to the road for democracy. How do we get past this, whether it's a war or an unexpected war?
I guess it depends who you talk to in the administration of what they want. President Trump seems to really want negotiations and believe that this type of financial pressure will bring them to the table. I've talked to other administration officials who are kind of like, look, if they come to the table, great. If not, we'll just keep squeezing them, and we're going to dry up their ability to fund whether it's Hezbollah or Islamic Jihad or other proxies, and we're kind of willing to kind of wait them out. My sense from the Iranian side is that, you know, they've been told by the Europeans, probably by some of the members of the Obama crowd, that can wait these guys out. They're only going to be in office another 18 months. A Democrat's going to come in and commit to the Iran deal, this episode will pass. So my gut is still probably that's what the Iranians are betting on, that they can kind of bunker down and absorb this, and then there'll be a political change. But again, to see the Iranian oil exports, from what I've seen, go from a high of sometimes as much as 3 million down to below 500,000 barrels a day, that's a big shock. I think it's going to be tough for the Iranians to endure it for another 18 months, even though my gut is that's still their strategy.
Well, you mentioned other nations around the world. French President Emmanuel Macron has spoken to Iran's leader, you know, to try to see about taming some of these tensions. How effective was that?
I also saw that the foreign minister of the European Union, Federica Mogherini, is still going forward with this financial mechanism she's hoping to establish that could allow for European trade with Iran around American sanctions, which is a risky game because the Americans have said they try to sanction that too. You know, I think the Europeans are trying to play this intermediary role and also, like I said earlier, basically whisper to the Iranians that you could wait out Trump. At the same time, I don't think there's that much they can really do on the financial side. History, recent history has shown that no matter what European leaders and diplomats say, the businessmen listen to the United States because the dollar is so important. Important to their operations that they can't risk getting access to the U.S. financial system. So they tend to follow the U.S. lead, even if their governments don't always do it. So I think the Europeans' tools are limited. I think even, you know, you've got the Chinese and the Russians also playing the role of a friend of Iran and can help them maybe weather the storm. But even there, you've seen the Chinese diminish their purchases of Iranian oil. So it's a dangerous situation, no doubt.
You know, another big concern, obviously, as you mentioned, this is a dangerous situation. It's a dangerous part of the world. One small escalation could lead to who knows what with, you know, so much tension in the area. And we do know that Iran does have allies, some of them nefarious, you know, Hezbollah and the like, that could come to their aid. So how concerned are you that certainly the comments from the U.S. president, we could obliterate you, basically, you know, how dangerous is the rhetoric and how concerned are you that it would be not that difficult to see this turning into something very, very bad?
It is definitely dangerous. And I haven't seen this type of rhetoric in the, I don't know, 15 years or so that I've really watched and covered Iran. I will say this, if you really focus on this, the Iranians have for a long time done incredibly provocative things against the United States, whether it's allies in Lebanon blowing up the Marine barracks in 83 to the Iranians massively shipping in IEDs into Iraq after the invasion of 2003 and the Iraq war. And the U.S. always showed incredible restraint in not retaliating, even though there was so much evidence and intelligence that the Iranians were directly targeting American troops, often through their allies, but sometimes directly. Will this situation be directly where the U.S. will retaliate in ways that it hadn't in the past? It's totally possible, and that's why it's dangerous. But I'd also caution the fact that this stuff has been going on for a while, and the U.S. has often not retaliated in ways that President Trump did last week.
Jay Solomon is an adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the author of The Iran Wars. He was speaking with my colleague, Laurie London. Among the top stories in the world, Trump ratchets up verbal attacks on Iran. Mueller agrees to testify publicly before House committees. Palestinians reject economic vision of Trump's deal of the century. Trump to hold at least 8 bilateral side meetings at G20. China hopes Trump-Xi meeting will help ease escalating trade war. Expanded coverage of these and other stories is on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza clashed with Israeli forces Tuesday as they protested an economic initiative launched by the White House at a 2-day conference in Manama, Bahrain. As Robert Berger reports, the multi-billion-dollar Peace to Prosperity proposal to boost Palestinian and neighboring Arab states' economies is part of a Middle East plan heralded by President Donald Trump as the deal of the century, and it's spearheaded by his son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner.
The Peace to Prosperity Conference was initiated by U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law and Mideast envoy, Jared Kushner. The aim is to revive the peace process with economic incentives while putting aside the thorny political issues until later. The plan offers $27 billion in aid to the Palestinians, most of which would be financed by wealthy Arab states led by Saudi Arabia. Some $23 billion would be earmarked for poorer Arab states bordering Israel, namely Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt. The Palestinian Authority is boycotting the workshop, declaring that the plan is a whitewash and dead on arrival. Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya.
I have not seen in the document any reference to settlements. We have not seen in the document any reference to ending occupation. This workshop is simply a political laundry for settlements and a legitimization of occupation.
Israel is not attending the conference either because of Arab opposition to normalizing relations before the Palestinian problem is resolved. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is prepared to give the peace plan a chance.
We'll hear the American proposition, hear it fairly and with openness. And I cannot understand how the Palestinians, before they even heard the plan, reject it outright. That's not the way to proceed.
Kushner decided on a new approach after previous U.S. administrations tried and failed to resolve the thorniest issues of the conflict: borders, Palestinian refugees, Jewish settlements, and the status of Jerusalem. The Trump administration believes economic prosperity will benefit the entire region and curb extremism, but the Palestinians say they cannot be bought and that their homeland is not for sale. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Tuesday during an unannounced trip to Afghanistan, "The hour has come for peace in the war-torn country." Pompeo met with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani to discuss ongoing peace talks between the U.S. and the Taliban. The Secretary of State told reporters at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul the two men agree that peace is our highest priority and that Afghanistan must never again serve as a platform for international terrorism. Talks between the Taliban and Washington's peace envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, have focused on U.S. and NATO troop withdrawal and guarantees from the Taliban that Afghanistan would not again become a safe haven for terrorists to plan a global attack like the airborne assaults on the United States in 2001. Pompeo said the United States and the Taliban were close to a deal on countering terrorism.
All sides agree that finalizing a U.S.-Taliban understanding on terrorism and foreign troop presence will open the door to intra-Afghan dialogue and negotiation. That next step is at the heart of our effort.
Pompeo's stopover came before the seventh round of peace talks between the United States and Taliban officials aimed at ending the 18-year-old war. They are scheduled to resume on June 29th in the Qatari capital of Doha. Pompeo said that the United States has no intention of dictating the outcome of those talks.
It's not America's role to dictate the outcome of those negotiations. We've been clear that success or failure of the bilateral relationship and Afghanistan's relationship with the international community, including the donor community, will rest in part on what Afghans do to maintain the civil rights of women and minorities and preserve the gains of the last 18 years.
The U.S., with British support, began attacking Taliban forces in 2001 after the insurgent group failed to hand over Osama bin Laden following the terrorist attacks on the United States on September 11, 2001. Pompeo stopped in Afghanistan on his way to New Delhi for meetings with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and other officials. The U.S. Special Representative to Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, says direct U.S. military intervention in that country is still an option to support efforts to oust President Nicolas Maduro. Speaking at a State Department press briefing on Tuesday, Abrams continued to call for Maduro to step down.
We support interim President Guaido's efforts. the barrier to a peaceful resolution remains Maduro's refusal to step aside.
The United States is one of 54 countries supporting opposition leader Juan Guaido, who declared himself interim president in January. Maduro maintains support from China and Russia, who are key allies. Venezuela has been mired in an economic crisis, with inflation above 1,000,000% and citizens forced to do without essential goods and services. The UN says 4 million Venezuelans have fled their country's political and economic crisis in recent years, creating a migration crisis in nearby countries like Colombia and Peru. Asked if the U.S. would consider taking in more displaced Venezuelans, Abrams said he expected more to arrive as Venezuelan migration increases across the board.
There will unquestionably be more Venezuelans coming to the United States because there will be more Venezuelans going everywhere. You've seen the, I think it's the UN estimate. We're now up to about 4 million, others would say higher. And it's going to hit, you know, at a certain point, it'll hit 5 million. The numbers in the U.S. are small compared to the numbers in, say, Colombia or Peru. And they grow faster, needless to say, in the countries that are nearer to Venezuela.
Abrams said that granting Venezuelans temporary protected status is also under consideration. TPS would protect Venezuelans from deportation and enable them to work and travel within the United States. Asked if the U.S. would consider working with President Maduro, perhaps integrating him into a unity government, Abrams expressed doubt, pointing at past failed talks.
The regime is methodically working to destroy Venezuela's democratically elected parliament. So we ask the nations of the Lima Group, the International Contact Group, the members of the European Union, and indeed all democracies to stand behind the National Assembly and denounce the regime's systematic persecution.
The special representative said that he hopes that the two representatives left in Venezuela after UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet visited there last weekend would be allowed to visit dissident prisoners and be able to tell the world about the true conditions there.
We are hoping that the High Commissioner's representatives who are currently in Venezuela, who stayed there when she left, will visit the country's most notorious prisons and visit political prisoners. And we hope that her report, which is due out July 5th, will reveal the brutal truths that victims of the regime suffer every day.
Tuesday's briefing came as the USNS Comfort, a Navy hospital ship, makes its way to Venezuela carrying humanitarian aid. President Maduro previously blocked several tons of aid from the U.S. and Brazil in February, going as far as to temporarily close Venezuela's borders with Colombia and Brazil. The acting head of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency, John Sanders, has resigned his position amid an uproar over the discovery of migrant children being held in squalor and filth in one of the agency's stations in Texas. Sanders sent a message to agency employees that he would step down July 5th. He did not give a reason for leaving. His departure comes after a barrage of criticism in recent days over conditions at the CBP holding facility in Clint, Texas. Ilora Mukherjee is a professor of law and the director of the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Columbia Law School. She said that she and a team of lawyers found children in miserable conditions at Clint.
The children there were hungry, dirty, sick, scared, and all of them who I interviewed had been detained for longer than the 72-hour limit that the law requires.
Mukherjee said that she was horrified by the conditions at Clint, which was not built to hold the number of people being detained there.
Most of the children hadn't showered for weeks since they had crossed the border. They don't have regular access to toothbrushes. Some of the children had brushed their teeth for the first time last week because we were there. The children are dirty. They're wearing the same dirty clothing that they crossed the border in. The children's clothing has bodily fluids on it. There is nasal mucus, snot all over their clothing. There's urine on their pants. For the teenage mothers who are breastfeeding, there are breast milk stains all over their shirts.
By Tuesday, many of the children had been moved out of the Clint facility. However, as Sanders's resignation was being made public, Customs and Border Protection announced that 100 of the children would be returned to Clint. Late Tuesday, the House of Representatives voted 230 to 195 to pass a $4.5 billion aid package to address the border issues. The Republican-run Senate is working on its own version, and President Trump has vowed to veto the House's version. The battle for the Democratic Party's 2020 presidential nomination kicks into high gear this week with the first of what will be monthly debates among the candidates leading up to the first caucus and primary votes early next year. The first debates will be held over two nights. One's tonight and one is Thursday, and they will feature 10 different contenders in each night vying for the right to take on President Donald Trump in November of 2020. Kyle Condick is the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. He says with 20 candidates in these debates, voters shouldn't expect a huge change in the race.
Look, I mean, it's a gigantic field on both nights. A lot of these candidates will be basically appearing in front of a true national audience first time, and so it's possible that someone will be able to break through who previously has not been a major polling candidate at this point. But, you know, even, you know, a lot of the candidates really aren't going to get that much time. There's not going to be much opportunity for interaction given how big the field is. And so I think expecting that there's going to be some huge change in the race that comes out of this debate may not necessarily be warranted, even though it's quite possible that there could be some sort of change and that maybe one of the low polling candidates will have some sort of moment in the debate that allows them to sort of become part of the bigger conversation featuring, you know, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, etc.
So far, former Vice President Joe Biden has had the best poll numbers. Kyle Condick says that the rest of the Democrats can take a lesson from the 2016 debates featuring now President Donald Trump.
You know, most of the highly polling candidates are going to be on the stage with Biden on the second night of the debate. I think back to the 2016 cycle when I think there was an assumption amongst many Republicans and many other observers that Donald Trump would eventually fall off, and therefore a lot of the Republicans spent their time attacking one another instead of attacking Trump. And of course, Trump never ended up falling off.
Condick told VOA that while going after a perceived frontrunner in your own party is a risky strategy, some of the Democrats might have to go after Biden in order to have a chance.
If these candidates really want to make an impact, I think they can't just go up to something different, because otherwise, if Biden is still leading this race after the first few debates, it means that his support is actually hard as opposed to soft. I think that it's important for these other candidates to try to stop Biden early in this process and not allow him to exercise sort of a firm grip on this field.
Though there will be 10 candidates on the stage each night in Miami, Kyle Condick says that he believes President Trump will also be a key figure in these debates.
Well, look, you're going to see lots of criticism of the president, just like in, say, 2012 when Barack Obama was the unchallenged incumbent president. A bunch of Republicans were trying to compete for the right to face him. The debates in some ways were kind of just all centered around bashing Obama. I think there'll be some of that dynamic with the Democrats and Trump as well.
Kyle Condick is the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. The Democratic debate, the first of two, starts at 01 hours UTC Thursday in Miami, Florida. And U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who issued a report in April on Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election, that is, will testify in open session before the House of Representatives Judiciary and Intelligence Committees on July 17th. The panel's Democratic chairman made that announcement on Tuesday. Representative Jared Nadler, the head of the Judiciary panel, and Representative Adam Schiff, who's the chairman of the intelligence panel, said in a joint statement that Mueller had agreed to testify after the two committees issued subpoenas on Tuesday. Coming up, there's new hope for the Black Rhino, and Lady Gaga rocks the Apollo. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Lady Gaga rocks the Apollo, but first, five critically endangered eastern black rhinos are getting used to their new homes in the Ankagara, that is, park in Rwanda. Three female and two male rhinos from the Verkhrelove Zoo in the Czech Republic, Flamingoland in Britain, and Ree Park Safari in Denmark first met in the Czech park in November. Jess Gruner is the manager of Ankagara National Park. He says a rhino called Manny from the Czech Republic is the oldest male.
That is the oldest of the males. We brought two males and three females. He's the oldest. He was born in Czech Republic in Verkhrelove. Then we have Jasmina, who was also born in Czech Republic at Verkhrelove. And then we have Olmoti, who was brought up in Flamingoland. In the UK, we have Mandela, who was brought up in Denmark, and we have Yaziri, who was also brought up in Czech Republic. So three from the Czech Republic, one from the UK, and one from Denmark, under the East Africa Association of Zoos and Aquariums, European Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
The rhino population of Rwanda was wiped out during the genocide in the 1990s. More than 50 black rhinos lived in the savanna habitat at Ankagara Park, but their numbers declined due to wide-scale poaching. Last confirmed sighting of a rhino in the park, 2007. The five new occupants join a group of 18 rhinos introduced into the park in 2017. Jess Gruner says that Ankagara got the five because of its previous success with reintroducing rhinos to the wild.
We demonstrated that the model of bringing rhinos back to Ankagara works, it's sustainable. Our 18 rhinos have thrived within Ankagara and Rwanda. There are now 20 of them, and EASA saw what we do to look after these animals, so felt that this was the best place to bring them within the African continent.
Veronica Verikova, a patron of the Rhinos from Europe to Rwanda project, says that Rwanda's attitude towards the endangered animals made it the best choice.
There is a huge commitment to conservation, tourism, and security, first and foremost. And so that was, all those boxes got checked, and it was a very easy decision to bring them here. We have to identify safe pockets in Africa to bring these animals to. There are some countries, the animals are really struggling because of the poaching. This is not the case in Rwanda. Rwanda takes these things extremely seriously. It's a national security, and it's security of its natural wealth.
According to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the eastern black rhino is in critical danger of becoming extinct. African rhinos generally remain under intense pressure from poachers who kill them to meet demand for their horns in illegal markets, primarily in Vietnam and China. And Lady Gaga brought an enthusiastic crowd to its feet for nearly 2 hours Monday night at the famed Apollo Theater in Harlem. In her first show in New York in 2 years and her first ever at the Apollo, Gaga unleashed a 90-minute celebration that featured multiple costume changes and her hits Just Dance, Poker Face, Million Reasons, and Born This Way. She also gave a shout-out to Pride Month. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
This is VOA.